Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Want to make $1 million an hour? Some people do. Hedge fund managers. The top manager earned $2.4 million an hour in 2010. How long would it take you to make that on your present rate of earnings? Probably decades. How do they do that? Where does all that money come from? It turns out much of the wealth sloshing around at the tippy top has actually come from the 99.9% below. Les Leopold's new book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, reveals the links between the obscene levels of wealth made by hedge fund managers and such financial crises as the European sovereign debt crisis and the mortgage meltdown. He shows how hedge funds bet against investors and won, beggaring people, school districts, unions, and municipal governments, so some people can pull down millions of dollars per hour. Les Leopold's last book was the acclaimed Looting of America. He's executive director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York, and also writes for Alternet. Well, Les Leopold, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
How to Make $1 Million an Hour. What an attractive title. Tell us a little bit about why you pitched this title the way it was.
Well, I was very concerned about our normal dialogue about inequality. It goes something like this. We say, okay, there are lots of rich people and there's poor people and it's too bad they're poor people and we should probably tax the rich to help the poor. That's sort of the liberal version of the argument. And the assumption is that how these super wealthy people make their money is A, legitimate, B, worthwhile to the U.S. economy, that they are the, you know, the makers. And we never dig in to what they really do. So I had come across some astounding incomes that these people make in finance. And I wanted to ask the question of whether or not what they do produces value in connection with all that money that they make. For example, it is assumed that in our economy, if you get paid a lot, it must mean you're making a heck of a contribution. Okay, so if you're Lady Gaga, it means a lot of people like your music and you make a lot of money because they like your music and products get sold around you, etc. So I wanted to see what the phenomena was for people that make 100 times what Lady Gaga makes or 100 times what Bruce Springsteen makes.
Let's go right to some of these numbers. What does 100 times Lady Gaga, what Lady Gaga makes mean?
The top hedge fund earner earned $2.4 million an hour in 2010. That's after the financial crash hit. That was the equivalent of what an average family makes in 47 years. I knew there's something had to be wrong with that. It's not possible for one person to produce that much value in exchange for that amount of money. There had to be something else going on. So let's say the top 10 musicians in this country, their average income is about $24,000 an hour, which is a lot. We can understand what they do, but here's somebody making 100 times that, and we have no idea what they do. So this book is about figuring out what do they do? Does it produce any real value for our economy? And if it doesn't, then we have to delegitimize them because that group of people, they set the bar for inequality in this country. If some 40-year-old hedge fund trader is making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you can bet that every CEO in the country wants to make a lot more money too. So the bar is set by these high-flying financiers. So we better understand what they're doing, or we have no hope, I think, of dealing with inequality.
You use a rubric of a guide to the rest of us to get to that 1%. But before we kind of dive into the meat of this, I think a lot of people think that they have a shot at it. But you disagree with that. You don't think most of us really have a shot at becoming a hedge fund manager who can make $1 million an hour.
Well, first of all, we're talking about the 100th of the top 1%. We're talking about the people who have the highest incomes in the United States. And you have a shot of winning the lottery. You have a shot at this as well. But what might hold you back is your ethics, which is you don't get to the top without cutting a few corners, ethical corners. For example, as district attorney from New York raised the question of whether hedge funds, in fact, had a fundamentally corrupt business model. He had found so much outright lawbreaking among hedge funds that he questioned whether or not the whole thing was based on a corrupt business model. I don't know if that's the case, but I think, as the book, I think, shows pretty clearly, most of what they do that makes a huge amount of money, the rest of us would call cheating. So there's a question, there's a big question about whether or not they produce anything positive for the economy.
Okay, so first of all, I think all of us have a vague idea of what a hedge fund is, but what is a hedge fund?
A hedge fund is basically a investment fund for the super rich. You have to have a minimum income of $200,000 to participate in a hedge fund, and you have to have a net worth of $1 million. Institutions, large institutions, also use hedge funds to invest. And the key message of a hedge fund is they are saying that we will get you a higher return than you can get in any kind of standard investment, like a mutual fund or in the stock market. And that extra return they call alpha. So alpha is what they get minus what you could get by just investing in the regular old stock market. And this itself is a kind of interesting concept, because basically wealthy people believe that because they're wealthy, they're entitled to make a higher rate of return than everybody else by just giving their money to somebody else. So I'm super rich. I give my money to a hedge fund manager. I expect to get double digit returns. Even now, while most people are getting virtually nothing, they're expecting huge returns. By the way, that's the secret of Bernie Madoff. The reason people didn't question Bernie Madoff is he gave them that 12% return year in, year out, 1% a month. And the people who gave him money felt they were entitled to that return, that's the privilege of being rich. So we took a look at how they create these alpha returns. How is it possible for someone to make a huge return by managing money? How do they do that? So the book is broken into kind of a step-by-step guide of the various ways that you can go about making your $1 million an hour.
I think a lot of folks might be confused between equity funds and hedge funds. You know, people talk about, well, Wall Street is really important because these are the job creators, the people who provide the money for investment in the kinds of industries that are going to hire people. Talk about that.
Yeah, let's cut through the crap. Let me tell you how the guy made his $2.4 million an hour. And then you can, the listener, and you can decide on whether this is worthwhile. Here's what happened. The guy colluded with Goldman Sachs to create a financial instrument that was designed to fail so he could collect the insurance on the failure. All right, that sounds weird, right? Let me put it in the most parochial terms. Imagine a builder builds a house that's designed to burn up. He's done the wiring precisely in a way that guarantees within 6 months it'll burn up. And then the builder takes out a insurance policy on the house so that he can collect the insurance. That's what they did with this financial instrument. What they did was they gathered together the worst subprime mortgages they could find in the worst areas of the country that were beginning to go into default. And they enticed investors to put up $1 billion, thinking that this was a good investment that was actually going to gain in value and that they were going to get a nice interest rate from these mortgages. They didn't know that the mortgages that were contained in here were failing rapidly and would fail rapidly. Basically, the money that these investors put up, they were acting as an insurance company. And the hedge fund guy was paying premiums to them. That was their interest rate. But if the default rate reached a certain level, he would take the entire insurance claim. He would get $1 billion. So he designed the instrument so that it would fail so he could collect $1 billion. Now, what's interesting, obviously, somebody didn't tell the investors what was really going on. The government investigated. Goldman Sachs had to pay a $450 million fine for not being honest with the investors. But the hedge fund guy got to keep his $1 billion.
So you're talking here, I think it's been called the greatest trade ever. Is this the one that is involved with Magnetar? Are you talking about the Magnetar trade?
Actually, I wasn't. But all the banks, big banks did it. A hedge fund called Magnetar did it. A Citigroup did it. JP Morgan Chase did it. They all did this. They all saw that the housing market was starting to go sour, and they found a way to milk it. And the hedge fund folks were designing these things so they would explode. It wasn't just a crash was happening and they were betting against the market. And they were these great analysts that figured out the housing boom had gone too far and they were going to make money when it was collapsing because they were smarter than the banks and smarter than all these other investments. No, they don't play it that way. You don't make this kind of money by just making bets. You make this money by rigging your bet. You don't risk $1 billion on a bet. When this guy put up his $1 billion, he designed the product so that it would fail and collapse. The Wisconsin school system somehow got hooked up in a bet like this, and they put up $200 million. These are five school districts in Wisconsin. And their bet went sour in 6 months. When I first read that, I thought, oh, what terrible luck. I mean, they shouldn't have gambled on this. They shouldn't have, gotten involved in high finance, and whoever advised them, is crazy. And I investigated that one very carefully in my last book. But I was naive. They didn't just have bad luck. They were sold something that was designed to explode in 6 months. The whole gambling around these subprime mortgages on the way up and on the way down, that the hedge funds were involved on both sides, that was what caused the housing bubble. And that's what caused the explosion in the housing bubble as well, why it went down so quickly. By doing what they did, they accelerated the crash.
So you're saying basically these hedge funds, what they did is they kind of bundled up all these really shaky mortgages. They picked out the worst possible mortgages that they could find, the one that they knew were going to go under. And that's what they sold as a good investment to, like, this Wisconsin school system. And so what did Goldman Sachs, or what did the banks have to do with it? Because they were inclusion. What did they get out of it?
Oh, they got enormous fees. First of all, they get the hedge fund's business. There's fees up and down the line on this. And they also got to unload any trash that they had warehoused on their books. They got to get rid of stuff that they had lying around that they didn't want to have. They got rid of their risky stuff. Matter of fact, I'm almost certain that's what happened in the Wisconsin case. It didn't even have to be housing stuff. It could be car loans, whatever debt instruments they had that they wanted to protect themselves from crashing. They threw them into this stuff. So there's a lot in it from the banks, huge amount. Also, banks invest in hedge funds. Banks have internal operations that are just like hedge funds. So people are going back and forth between the banks and the hedge funds. This is a very symbiotic relationship, highly profitable on both sides. It's even weirder, though, than you just described. Here's where, I think listeners might put cotton in their ears. They didn't assemble real mortgages. That's not the way they play this game. They assemble bets on real mortgages.
So they don't actually own a lot of these mortgages.
Nope. They don't own any of them. For those people who understand how fantasy sports works, fantasy baseball, you can pretend to own something and make a bet on it without actually owning it. And that's how they construct these things. They don't have to worry about the mess and bother of actually owning a subprime mortgage. They can just go look for the worst areas where there are these subprime mortgages and then make the bets on them.
We're talking with Les Leopold. His first book was The Acclaimed Looting of America. The book he's just come out with is How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Now, you mentioned before how the whole use of these instruments, betting on the failure of the housing market, as well as the rapid velocity of trades and trading, really contributed to the crash and to the intensity of the crash. There's another area in which you connect the dots between hedge funds currency that operate around currencies and economic crisis, the crisis that's affecting Europe, the sovereign debt crisis. Now, this was a wholly new thing to me. And for this, you start out with one of the icons of liberalism. That's George Soros. And he doesn't come out smelling exactly like a rose here. Tell us what happened. How did he make his billion or $5 billion? Connect the dots for us.
George Soros was the first person in the hedge fund business to figure out that not only can you make big bets, but you can actually shape events so that the bet will succeed. So he got involved in a complicated period in the growth of the European Union. George Soros understood perfectly well that it was a good thing for Europe to create a common market because there had been two world wars. His family had been extremely impacted by what happened in World War II. But there was a golden opportunity that was created because on the way to creating the euro, countries had to keep their currencies within a certain level. And if the currency went outside that level, the central bank of the country had to do something to bring it back into line. And how they do that is kind of complicated for kind of an on-the-air explanation. But basically, Soros and his partners bet that England would be unable to maintain its currency within this range. So they basically placed a huge bet that it wasn't going to happen. And by placing that big bet, they were, in fact, dragging the currency out of the realm. And they were able to throw together basically a billion-dollar bet, but when other people saw that he was doing it, they piled on too, and they literally created the outcome that they wanted to see happen. And as a result, the money was a transfer from the British people. The net result of what happened was that the people of England ended up having to lose many billion dollars that were transferred to these banks and these traders in banks and in hedge funds who were trying to destabilize the currency. And what's really interesting about this is 20 years earlier, James Tobin, the Yale Nobel laureate, had predicted that this very kind of thing was going to happen, that if we let money move rapidly around the world and we let these traders, currency, they used to call them just speculators, if we let these hedge funds speculate on currencies, that they would be able to destabilize those currencies and it would have no connection to the reality of what was going on in those economies. So Soros kind of led the way. A lot of people's eyes lit up after that and said, whoa, what a great way to play the game. So what's going on now, for example, is there are hedge funds who target a particular bank in Europe that may have some issues. And what they do is they will put out the word, they will start planting stories about how screwed up that bank is. And they will, in some cases, they will flat out lie. They'll try to plant rumors. And they will try to get a destabilization situation going so they can make their bets. And they're not going to make their bets unless they're pretty sure that they can destabilize the situation. So the more instability they can get going, the more they can collect on their bets. So it's in the interest of hedge funds to destabilize any situation that they can.
So I just want to see if I understand this. You're saying that the hedge funds bet against certain banks so that they could win their bets. And then what happened? Those banks then went to the countries and said, you need to pay us back before you do social services for your people. I mean, is that too simplistic?
Well, I think what you get is a crisis situation where it all comes together. First of all, Europe's in trouble because they trusted our banks, right? They bought our junk. They bought these subprime crazy, you know, instruments that were designed to fail and a whole bunch of other things. So their banks, the European banks, were crashed just like our banks did. And the bailouts were severe. But it's more complicated in Europe because the individual countries no longer have their own currencies. So they can't just, the way the Fed's basically printing money to help keep the economy going, that was not an option. It would be like Mississippi. If we didn't pick up the debts for Mississippi and we just said, okay, you're on your own. Yeah, you're a poor state. Too bad. Tighten your belt because we're not providing Social Security for you. We're not providing a Medicare or Medicaid for your people anymore or aid to education or anything like that. You're on your own. So countries at the periphery, Greece, Ireland, you know, they're called the pigs, were in serious trouble. But the banking system now is tied to this wobbly euro that's in serious trouble. So there's great opportunities for the hedge funds to make it worse. In other words, if the boat's rocking and they can make it rock more, they might be able to sink it.
We're talking with Les Leopold about his new book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour. One of the points you make in this book is that a lot of the money that's being put up for the bets by hedge fund managers is actually very little. Where are they getting the rest of their money?
Really, it's coming from us. What happened, basically from the New Deal all the way till 1970, there was a very intimate relationship between the productivity of the U.S. economy and what the average wage was. When productivity went up, people got paid more. And the post-World War II boom, year in, year out, productivity went up, workers' real wages, families' real wages went up, and the standard of living in the post-World War II period went up incessantly. And by the way, productivity has gone up incessantly ever since. But in the 70s, something new happened. And in the 1970s, a new philosophy emerged. And that philosophy was that the way to build a better economy was through tax cuts, primarily for the wealthy, and deregulation. And by the way, if we could tame these unions, that would be a good idea too. So a more union-free environment with deregulation of all kinds, and tax cuts for the wealthy. The deregulation that had the most profound effect was the deregulation of the financial sector, because in effect, we forgot everything that we learned from the 1929 crash. After that crash, we sat on Wall Street like never before and never since. It became a very sleepy place to work. The wages on Wall Street were no higher or no lower than anywhere else in the economy. But after deregulation, the wages on Wall Street shot through the roof. And what happened was, for the first time, real wages for the American worker stalled and basically went flat and, in fact, went down a little. But productivity kept going up miraculously. So if you view these things as two lines, imagine the two lines going up and they're identical, and then they split apart. Well, the gap between the two lines is a huge amount of money. I estimate it's like $3 trillion this year. Well, that money then is available because it's gone to the top fraction of the 1%. That's where it's gone. It doesn't just disappear. It's there. So you had a huge amount of money in the hands of a few, and that money was there to invest with a guy like Soros, loan to a guy like Soros, and that was the money that then fueled the incredible housing bubble and fueled the creation of all these, you know, ridiculous financial instruments. It was there because no longer went to the average working person.
You have this huge transfer of wealth that you're talking about in this book, How to Make $1 Million an Hour. The political power that goes with that transfer is enormous. What can we do about this?
We're talking about, I think, the central problem in the globe right now. And doing something about it is going to require incredible organization and incredible patience. I think we saw during Occupy Wall Street that Wall Street itself, that high finance is incredibly vulnerable. Let's go back and remember what was going on. In the summer of 2011, before Occupy Wall Street, that's when Obama offered his grand bargain to deal with austerity. The conversation was about austerity. We have to tighten our belt. We have to cut Social Security. Occupy Wall Street hit, the conversation changed entirely. We were talking about the 1% and the 99%. And basically, the message was, you know, Wall Street is the problem. Wall Street should pay for the damage it's done. The national conversation changed. When Occupy Wall Street was driven away, the conversation went right back to austerity. So that tells us two things. One is that mass demonstration, mass mobilization can change the conversation. And two, it tells us that we have to sustain it, that you can't just, you know, expect it to happen like, you know, Tahrir Square, kind of, it's just going to mushroom and build on itself. Actually, there's a third thing it says. It says that the American people are really angry at what happened. And when you give them a target where the fundamental problem comes from, which is high finance, when you give them that target, they respond positively. It wasn't just that the occupiers, that was just the tip of the iceberg. The fact is, there were millions of people who were sympathetic to what was going on, but there was nothing for them to do. They were sending money to Occupy Wall Street. They didn't even know what to do with it. They had so much money. But they were looking for, can't we do something about Wall Street? So I think mobilization is key. I don't think it's going to happen through the political process as now constructed, because both parties are desperate to get this money. Hedge funds are the darlings, the absolute darlings of the political process. Oh my God, they have so much money. Yes, please donate to my campaign. Yes, I'll listen to your lobbyists. And one of the most important political things that we could demand is a financial transaction tax, which is a small tax on the buying and selling of every kind of financial instrument. And what this does is really eliminate the high-frequency traders, who in fact are extracting a tax from everybody else. If you have money in a pension fund or a mutual fund or anything like that, when those people go into the stock market to make their deals, a high-frequency trader is getting there before them, selling it back to them, and making a few pennies out of every trade millions of times a second. And that comes out to be $5 to $20 billion a year that goes into their pockets. You have a financial transaction tax, that money goes from Wall Street to Main Street. I calculated that a financial transaction tax, a modest one, could provide enough money so that every single kid in this country that wanted to go to college at a public university could go tuition free. Now, that would take a burden off a lot of American families. That would be, you know, really good for people. And, you know, Wall Street wouldn't miss it. They'd be fine. The whole thing is we have to shrink them back down to size. We have to make it a sleepy place instead of, you know, this incredible opportunity to rip people off. I mean, we've just touched the tip of the iceberg here. I mean, when people read the book, you're going to read about insider trading, and you're going to really understand this high-frequency trading. And you're going to come across a whole bunch of each chapter is like another technique that people, that these hedge funds use to rip people off. And we don't need that. It's not good for the economy. And most importantly, those people should not be the showcase for this is what you want to be. The best and the brightest come out of universities and they go, I want to be in a hedge fund. And by the way, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital, they slide back and forth. And some hedge funds do all of it. But the money manipulation, the pure money manipulation, I think is something we could live without, or great live without. Instead of having our best and brightest going into that, they should be going into, you know, medicine, education. If they want to be entrepreneurs, you know, create things that would be good for the environment. For example, there's a zillion things that we need to have done. We don't need this to be done.
I should mention that Europe, it looks on track to actually be passing a transaction tax, or it may already have done so. Is that right?
11 countries in Europe are beginning with a very modest financial transaction tax, and they're doing it in a way that makes it very hard for the country, for people in those countries to cheat. You can't just run away from the tax if you won't be able to do business in that country. So if you try to avoid the tax by going elsewhere, you basically forfeit your right to do business in the country where the transaction is taking place. And if you try to avoid it by, you know, using the Hong Kong or Singapore market or something like that, you still owe the tax. Now, I asked Timothy Geithner in the book, who was Treasury Secretary at the time, I asked him whether or not he favored the financial transaction tax. Oh, no, he didn't answer me personally, of course, but his, you know, press aide gave me a comment that could be attributed to a high spokesperson in the Treasury Department. And basically they said is, we don't think it's a good idea. We think it would be avoided. We think it would cause problems in collecting it. And we prefer something else. But the something else they prefer, by the way, hasn't passed either. But there's a movement afoot on this financial transaction tax because Europe's going to show that it can be done. There's a movement afoot, actually spearheaded by the National Nurses United, which grew out of the California Nurses Association, which is a very progressive union of nurses. And they're basically, talking about using this financial transaction to fund, you know, the creation of green jobs or something like that. And you can go to their website and you can see what they're doing. And they go around arguing for what they call a Robin Hood tax they're a group that's really trying to mobilize around it, and I'm hoping that the rest of the progressive community will join them at some point. My only problem is that I don't like calling it a Robin Hood tax because it's sort of like, rob from the rich, give to the poor. This is an anti-speculative tax. That's what it really is. It's basically saying what they're doing. Your wealth that you're getting out of this is phony. I mean, you're stealing. And this is a way to put a stop to it. Nobody needs to make a million trades in a second. Nobody. The only purpose to do that is to rip somebody else off. You're not doing that because, you know, markets are, you know, you have a real economic interest. It does no good for the economy to have somebody make a million trades in an hour. Not only do they do that, I'll give you one more thing that they do. They actually make a million trades and cancel them in a minute. They'll make a million trades in a minute to cancel it just to see what you're willing to pay. They offer it. We'll sell you this at $12.19, and you're ready to buy it. They pull it back. Then they offer it again at $12.20. You willing to buy it? They pull it back. And so they try to boost up the price until they feel they've got you where they want you, and then they'll sell it to you. So this is just bad stuff. You don't need this. Again, of course, there's a mountain of literature that says how wonderful this is, and it's just sycophants writing. It's just not true.
Well, it's a terrific book, and it's also really funny to read. I actually laughed out loud. It's also quite explains things, I think, in very clear and simple language. The book is How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. We've been talking with Les Leopold. Thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.